JSA in the 90s. This episode, Justice Society of America number 2, cover dated May 1991. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I'm not doing this alone, folks. Thankfully, I'll be joined by a buddy to help me cover this issue. My co-host today, he's a fellow podcaster who's produced hundreds and hundreds of episodes covering topics such as monster and horror comics, superhero comics with a special love for Bob Haney, and even our beloved All-Star Squadron. But perhaps he is best known for his deep love and affection of bare feet. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Billy D. Welcome to the JSA Brownstone, Billy. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Well, this is how I'm doing. I'm figuring out how I can amputate someone's feet without them knowing.
So there's a long history here, folks. If you've ever followed me on social media, I like to read books, and I take a photo of the book, and typically I accidentally slip the foot in the background of the photo, because whenever I post a picture of the book, no one talks about the book. They only talk about my feet. So I put that out there, and Billy, apparently, even though he's got two at the end of his own legs, has some weird hatred for feet. What is up with that, man?
It's a phobia. I don't know what it is. It's just, they're gross. They're the grossest things ever. Yours, mine, everybody's. And yes, I've even told my wife hers are gross too.
I mean, in full disclosure, his wife and I staged an intervention at the Baltimore Comic Con.
This is true.
We all took photos of our feet together. We tried to get Billy over this, and she even thinks it's strange, and it's just not normal, man.
At least we all had shoes on. Oof.
Well, before this turns into an OnlyFans podcast, we should probably talk about other stuff. For example, Billy, not only have you have like, I don't know, something like 400, 500 episodes out there of podcasts yourself, one of the series you produced was A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, right?
Yeah, that was, created and hosted by myself and Herman Lowe. We had a blast with it. It was a series that we both got into many, many years ago and both just loved. I feel like everybody loves that series. And we were just like, why don't we talk about it and get in front of a microphone? And there was a great reaction. Everybody got the nostalgia kick from it. Always lots of feedback. It was a great experience.
It was a great show. Again, for a great comic, you had a ton of great guests. I know folks that have been on this show, was on your show. Sean Ross was there. Martin Gray. Lots of different people helped you out with that coverage. And such fun series. And then you went into the 1970s comics, JSA's All-Star Comics as well. Really fun series. And all those are out there for people to find. Is that what it's under? Is A World on Fire?
Yep. So floating around out there. I was still trying to get maybe one or two episodes out a year to just kind of keep it relevant, but it's just getting harder and harder to do that.
Well, I know you warmed up the feed for last year's JS April, so we appreciated you joining in on the fun.
That was a blast. Yeah, I used to try to always every Christmas talk a Christmas comic with Mark Gray because he's literally Mr. Christmas, but it just didn't happen this year. He's the biggest Christmas fan I know.
He's a great guy, no doubt about that. And I'm not just saying that because I need him to do an episode with me coming up in the future. But now you and I have podcasted before together about The Spectre and Daredevil, and that was for your other show. What's your other big show that you do out there?
So the Daredevil Born Again, you and I and J. David Weider did for the main feed for Magazines and Monsters, and we had a blast with that. And then The Spectre was on the Bronze Age of Horror Comics, which, well, it's pretty self-explanatory, right? A little on the nose.
So I am seriously impressed with the volume of podcasts you put out. It's an insane amount of content. I don't know how you sleep. Certainly your wife probably never sees you, so I'm impressed, sir. And they're all great, by the way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that. I think I'm maybe 2 months away from being 7 years into it. So, yeah, fun.
Wow. See, I've been podcasting for 20 years now, and I don't think I've produced even the amount of content you have in 7. So your work ethic is showing, sir.
Well, thank you for saying so. I appreciate it. I'm just trying to have fun. Just want to talk comics and movies and stuff like that and have fun.
Well, hopefully we're going to have fun here today. But before we start talking about this issue of Justice Society of America, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library. Usually it's titled tied into this month's discussion in some way, shape, or form. Since Black Canary is the focus character of this issue, I picked Birds of Prey Murder and Mystery Trade Paperback. This is the 2024 edition. What this collects is the first 11 or 12 issues of Birds of Prey written by Gail Simone. So you got art in here by Ed Benes, Cliff Richards, and others. The cover is by Greg Land. If you've never read the Gail Simone Birds of Prey, I highly recommend it. I mean, I love the Chuck Dixon stuff, but when Gail Simone came on the book, she really took the series to another level. It's really fantastic. Huntress is a regular character at this point in the series. Super awesome comic. Cover art is by Greg Land. Page count is 296 pages. It's full color, a soft cover, and it normally goes for $24.99, but you can get on in-stock trades right now for 40% off, so it only costs you $14.99. That's a heck of a bargain for 300 pages of Gail Simone Birds of Prey. Highly recommended. So, Billy, I gotta ask, when all the cool kids come onto the show, they bring an in-stock trades pick. I don't have a lot of hope for what you got here. Maybe it's feet-oriented. I don't know, but did you happen to bring something to discuss?
Yes, it's Bigfoot Volume 1. No, it's not Bigfoot Volume 1. It is a Black Canary Bird of Prey trade paperback from 2021. I was alerted about this. I had no idea it was even out by our dear friend living over there in Scotland, Mark Gray. He said to me, hey, did you see that Black Canary trade? And I said, sir, I have not. And wow, what a great trade this is. I mean, it's cover art by Carmen Infantino. It is a fantastic trade. It covers all the very early stories of Black Canary, 1947, 48, 49, all that stuff in there. Full color, soft cover, was $29.99, but you can get it in stock trades for $17.99. How awesome is that?
That's fantastic. I'm pretty sure this was released in conjunction with the Birds of Prey movie, if I remember correctly. So yeah, but that's a great opportunity to get some great stories from a range of eras, it looks like, because it's got the later Adventure comic stuff as well. So yeah, very cool. Good pick, sir.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Really, really nice trade. And one of these days, I'll definitely talk about it. Who knows when?
Folks, for this and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. This episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we need some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting Patreon.com/FW Podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks goes out to this all-star squadron of supporters, Alex Osias,
Al the Comics Guy,
Bill Beer,
Bruno Diaz,
Chris Mort,
Craig Fletcher,
David Ace Gutierrez,
DC Dave,
Devin Clancy,
Ducky,
Extremely Uncanny,
George Van Note,
Gord Tolton,
Jason Keane,
Jay Campbell,
Keith G. Baker,
Kevin Wetter,
Mark Baker Wright,
Matt Ev,
Michael Bailey,
Michael Crouch,
Mike Atchison,
Mike Zomkowski,
Roger Preeb,
Russell Burbage,
Symbol Pending,
Ted Kilvington,
and the Podcrasher, Tim Price.
Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. Now, I say this all the time, but go out on the social media, share your thoughts on this issue, on our discussion. You can find us as JSA Presents on most of the social medias. Of course, go out to our website and leave your comments there, because I do read your feedback at the end of the show. So be part of the community, guys, because it is all about building a bunch of JSA fans around the show. Now, this is the part where we get to talk to Billy and ask him, what is your personal origin story, Billy, with the JSA? How'd you discover the team, and, like, you know, how'd you fall in love with them?
Listen, so I have a horrible memory, but it definitely came from one of these three places. So either All-Star Squadron, because, you know, they had some interaction and some crossover there, or it could have come from the JLA-JSA team-ups as well, or the JSA Super Squad from the 70s. I think I got some early issues of that. So that's probably where it was, but it's got to be in one of those three avenues.
What was it about that you loved?
So I really like team books to begin with. And when they're a team of kind of, you know, I feel like the JSA is more street level kind of people, not these uber powerful people like the Justice League is. So I think they kind of resonated a little bit with me just because of that, because they're almost like, you know, ordinary people without superpowers and things like that, that were, you know, fighting the bad guys.
It's funny. They are a very strange hodgepodge of mystery men. I mean, they really are. I mean, Black Canary is a great example. Dr. Midnight, Wildcat, Adam, all those folks. And then you get essentially uber gods like Green Lantern, the Spectre, and Dr. Fate. So there's this huge divide between the power levels of the characters in this series. Because again, the Spectre can eat literally a battleship, and, you know, Al Pratt, you know, could maybe lift up a heavy bag of food or something. So it's a wildly different group. And I like when they actually show off the dynamics and the differences between them. They got better about that in the 2000s, trying trying to show the differences between the characters and say, you know, it is a bit of a hodgepodge. But yeah, the Mystery Men aspect, I love seeing the lower tier power level characters hanging out and doing stuff together. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's perfect summation of it right there. Like you said, there's some members that are more powerful and some that are just street level, and a good mix of people for sure.
Yeah. So for this episode, we always like to have a discussion topic. And given that you did a podcast about All-Star Squadron for years, and right now in the JSA book, they're doing a JSA Year One story, and you folks in the comments won't stop talking about how you wish there was a new modern All-Star Squadron comic book, I thought, and I should mention, this comic we're covering takes place in the 50s, right? So mix all that together, and the discussion we're going to have here is, Billy, you and I are now editors at DC Comics, and we're given the task of bringing a new All-Star Squadron series back. So how would we approach that, whether in any shape or fashion, however we want to talk about it? And so how would we do a new series? I guess it could be either JSA or All-Star Squadron, set in either the 1940s or 1950s. So how would you go about this? And I'll let you go first.
So I would love to do something where, you know, I understand sometimes timelines and things don't match up, but I would love to see a book where, you know, like they had the JLA, JSA team-ups in the 70s. I would love to be like, you know, hey, the JSA says to, you know, the JLA, hey, you know, we need some help over here on Earth 2. And JLA comes to Earth 2, but it's all a big setup, and they've gone evil. They've gone rogue. And there's a big, huge fight between these two supergroups. I would love to see that. I love it when bad guys fight bad guys and good guys fight good guys. I love that kind of stuff. But that's the route I would kind of go. What about you?
For me, I would be hesitant to set a book. If I was in charge of doing a new JSA or All-Star Squadron book, I'd be hesitant to set it during World War II, simply because All-Star Squadron's out there. And same thing happened with Roy Thomas, is that it sort of becomes a history lesson after a while. Like, you get so caught up in the reality of World War II that you're kind of having to make your story fit that. So instead, I would probably jump forward a little bit. I would go to after the war, maybe the late 1940s, you know, maybe start in 1946 or something like that. Just like you and I were talking about earlier, the Mystery Men, that's what I want. I want a book about the Mystery Men and women in action, battling the crooks and the super criminals, right? That's what I want to see. I want to see the heroism, the patriotism. I want to see them in their 20s, right? I want to see the youthful excitement, you know, mixed with also this angst of, you know, the war's over. What am I going to do with my life? I'm in my 20s. How do I start a future? You know, because you go through that in your 20s, right? So I don't know that we've seen these particular characters go through that.
I wouldn't mind seeing, you know, think about JSA or All-Star Squadron. Maybe, you know, you move past World War II and you can get into the Red Scare in the 50s, starting all the espionage and stuff like that. That would be great too.
Absolutely. And also, I think one thing that we didn't ever really get to see a lot of is the team dynamics, because, you know, back then it was a very straightforward, you know, story driven thing. And then even All-Star Squadron, as much as we all love it, and maybe you don't agree, but I always felt like Roy kind of made most characters a little samey. There wasn't a lot of friction there. So I want to see some of the team dynamics. I want to see who becomes best friends. I want to see who exactly doesn't like working together. You know, like, maybe Black Canary is a little tired of Al Pratt staring at her bottom, or maybe Carter Hall and Kent Nelson, when they're not in costume, are like the perfect bromance, because they're both, you know, archaeological kind of guys or something. I don't know. And then, and this is something I would do any comic I would ever work on. I would pace it like Geoff Johns did the JSA series in the early 2000s, where you'd have some one-and-done issues, you'd have some two-issue stories, you'd have some three-issue stories. Mix it up. Not everything needs to be a constant five-issue storyline or a six-issue storyline or a 12-issue storyline. Mix it up, and as long as you do your math right and do like a two-issue story, a one-issue story, and a three-issue story, you can still have your six-issue trade paperback and make the company happy. And I just think that that's the way you tell your stories. Set it in the late 40s, probably with the focus of the JSA, but you know what? Let's check in on the All-Star characters. Let's see what Johnny Quick is up to. Let's see what's going on with Robot Man. Let's see what's going on with Commander Steel or whoever else. And that's what I would want to see.
Yeah, and there's probably nobody better to do this than Geoff Johns, like you just mentioned.
Well, I have a complicated relationship there. I think the JSA series in the early 2000s is probably the best team book out of the 2000s. It is that stinking good. After a while, I think he was trying to tell a different story. You know, I think he had a different idea in mind. And like the most recent JSA run we had, that 12-issue series that he ran, wasn't my favorite. You know, I appreciate for what he was trying to do, but I wasn't in love with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know how I feel about modern comics anyway. Old curmudgeon.
There we go. So I think there's a lot of incredibly talented writers and artists out there that would make this a fantastic book. And as an editor, I would love to assign them and make them go off and do what I can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good plan.
So folks, chime in on the comments. We want to hear, how would you do either an All-Star Squadron or JSA book? How would you do that? And set it, in whatever time period you want to do. But you guys are always talking about how you wish you had a modern day All-Star Squadron book. Let us know how you would do that book. I'd love to see that. Now, we are going to get into this issue, folks. Remember, you can always go out to our gallery page on the Fire & Water Podcast website, and you can see some pages from this issue. I'm not going to put out a bunch of them, because, the fact is you can still find the floppy issues in places. It's on DC Infinite. You can buy it digitally. You can buy the trade paperback. It's available in a whole bunch of places, so I'm just going to put a few pages out there. But this is Justice Society of America number 2. Remember, this is the very first comic ever published with the name Justice Society of America. Very exciting. So this is issue number 2, published by DC Comics. Cover date is May 1991. It was on the shelves March 19th, 1991. Cover price is $1 for shiny quarters. And the cover is by the late, great Tom Lyle. You want to describe the cover for us, buddy?
Oh, yeah. So you've got me here. You have a monster, a sexy woman, and Egyptian stuff. That's all I need. You have me at that. You have the fantastic logo up top, part 2 of 8, featuring Black Canary. And I love corner boxes. We're missing corner boxes in comics these days. I love corner boxes. We have 5 of the JSA members there too. And Canary, she looks like she's kicking butt here. She's got some tough that she just knocked out with her right hand, holding onto his shirt. He's unconscious, basically falling on the floor. And she's looking at some Egyptian artifact here, almost like a headdress. There's 2 sarcophaguses, however you would say that, to her left. But then creeping up behind her is our buddy Solomon Grundy here, ready to, grab her, choke her, something like that. It's almost out of an old Universal horror flick with a woman and there's a monster coming up to get her.
That's a good point. It does sort of have the Universal monster flick going, especially with the Egyptian stuff there. You even have a pyramid in the background behind them. So absolutely, that's a good catch. And just to echo what you said, I love the logo. This is my favorite Justice Society logo. I love the corner box with the 5 JSA heads. Now, this is the second issue we've had it, but it's just a beautiful thing. It's just gorgeous. And Tom Lyle, wow, what an incredibly talented artist. I mean, this cover is not terribly complex or deep, but it is so effective, right? The layout is perfect. The use of the colors is great. It features the important characters. So you can't help but your eye be drawn to Black Canary, right? That is the center focus. And yes, she is sexy as hell. And then you notice Solomon Grundy sneaking up behind her. Then you notice the Egyptian headdress. Even though the headdress is in the foreground, you notice it after you notice Black Canary. It's just a really great way of laying it out. And then if you look at the colors, you've got that pyramid in the background and you've got these 3 purple stripes that go up out of the pyramid. It's just an effect, but it helps to set off the purples throughout the cover. It's really well done and a heck of a cover. And Tom Lyle, could you imagine the stuff he'd be doing today if he was still with us? It's just so sad that he's gone.
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, those 3 purple stripes there, I don't know what their purpose is, but they look really good. They really add just a really good touch to this. And yeah, fantastic cover. Like I'd probably say it's very, very highly rated for me, 8 out of 10, something like that.
Yeah, there we go. 8 out of 10 mummies. There we go. All right, well, let's get into this. It is the story is written by Len Strazewski. So the art, which is pencils and inks by Grant Meehan. Letter is Janice Chiang. Colorist is Tom Zuko. Editor is Mike Gold and Brian Augustin. The story is Vengeance from the Stars, Chapter 2. The issue is called The Sack of Gotham. You want to start us off, Billy?
Absolutely, my friend. So Gotham City is flickering in and out of darkness with power failures. Alan Scott takes to the airwaves as vice president and general manager of the Gotham Broadcasting Company. He's trying to calm a nervous city, explaining the rolling power failures and promising to continue broadcasting for as long as possible. While Alan tries to soothe the worried citizens, looters are taking advantage of the chaos, smashing storefronts and stealing television sets. That's when Black Canary makes her entrance. She skids into the fray on her motorcycle, dismantling the looters before they even know what hit them. Just as she's catching her breath, a police broadcast cackles about a burglary in progress at the Gotham Museum of Natural History. The transmission ends abruptly with gunfire. Canary races to the museum and finds a grim scene with wounded police officers and murdered security guards. Inside, 3 thieves are ransacking the Egyptian wing, snatching priceless artifacts. Canary unleashes a fury of moves using the Egyptian relics themselves to help her take down the thieves. With the room secured, she turns her attention to the item the crooks were trying to steal, the crown of Cheops. The ancient headdress, dated to 2000 BC, is etched with strange carvings. The inscription describes Cheops as the originator of the worship of celestial beings. Before Canary can ponder it further, two more criminals emerge from the shadows. One of them is Solomon Grundy, and he is not happy to see Black Canary again.
Now, meanwhile, far away at the Mount Pride Observatory in New Mexico, the true mastermind behind Gotham's chaos is monologuing about his victory. Ted Knight, Starman, is battered and humiliated and being mocked for the apparent death of the Flash. The mysterious villain twirls Ted's own gravity rod, revealing that Ted and his newly built observatory were always pieces on his cosmic chessboard. As a final insult, he tosses a fake beard onto Ted's desk, a clue to the disguise he used in the previous issue to trick Ted. Then, using the gravity rod in tandem with the observatory's telescope, the villain tears open the heavens and summons another constellation creature to Earth. This time, it's Sagittarius. Back at the museum, Black Canary and Grundy crash through the exhibits, through the hallways, and finally out into a nearby alleyway. She fights with determination and skill, knowing that she doesn't have the raw power to battle him hand to hand. She uses judo to turn Grundy's own weight against him. She holds her own against the zombie creature, knocking him down several times and even disorienting him. But Grundy doesn't give up and cracks her ribs in the struggle. She refuses to back down, but a well-timed blow from behind by one of the henchmen finally drops her. Grundy turns away, distracted by a familiar glow in the sky. The Green Lantern has arrived, and he's already locked in combat with Sagittarius high above Gotham. Continued next issue with the Green Lantern. All right, so let's crack this thing open, and you tell me, why don't you lead us off, buddy?
So, yeah, I did like how it started on the moment of, you know, our buddy the Green Lantern, a.k.a. Alan Scott here on television, because I had completely forgotten about how that was his day job. Like, I totally forgot about that. I did know it, but I completely forgot about that. So I love that it started on that, and then it comes full circle and ends with him as Green Lantern at the end of the issue. What did you think?
Oh, I didn't think about the bookmarking of that. That's clever. That's a good point. I liked seeing him in his, in his private life role, because, first of all, my dad was a general manager of a TV station growing up, and so my dad would have to do announcements like this from time to time. So it sort of reminds me of my dad doing that, but at the same time, you know, if you just think about it in the context of the comic, you know, the world's in crisis. Everything's falling apart. Where do you turn to? You look to the news, and here is he. He's not a newsman, but he's being the voice of sanity and trying to keep calm. So I love to see Alan Scott in that role.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the splash page. I love splash pages. They're just fantastic. And there's a crash from the looters here. I love it how they just start going bananas here. But wow, Black Canary. I love cars and even motorcycles in comics. Some artists, I feel, they excel at it. I don't know if it's because they just do their homework or they look a lot of photo reference or what they do. But the art team here really hits it with this motorcycle with Black Canary flying in here. It looks great.
One of the things that makes it look so cool is she's basically sliding into the action, and it looks like she was almost riding side saddle on the motorcycle so that she could leap off into action. You know, maybe she wasn't. Maybe she was riding, and we're just catching her as she's already flipped her leg over it. But she's just sliding right off the motorcycle, ready to go kick butt, which looks fantastic. I mean, she looks great. She looks heroic. She looks action-oriented. She also looks beautiful. So Grant Meehan really did a great job here. And you know, him doing pencils and inks is pretty impressive.
Absolutely. And I'd love to, there's got to be some comedy here. So the guy gets, the one loader gets absolutely pissed off because she messed up his hair. Now, I don't have hair to get messed up, but I'm just saying, even when I did have hair, if somebody would have flew by me on a motorcycle and messed up my hair, I don't think I would have got this pissed off.
Well, especially if I know I'm about to get my butt beat by, you know, a superhero or whatever, right? So the thing that cracks me up about this, and they don't come right out and say it, but, you know, we've all, you know, our generation grew up knowing about looters smashing open, you know, electronic stores and stealing TVs all the time, right? But this is the 1950s. So first of all, it's a furniture store, not an electronic store. And the TVs are these huge box things. So it actually takes three people to lift this television out of the store to steal, which I just found hilariously funny.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, the guy pulls a knife on her, tries to, you know, slash her with the knife, but he's basically a novice compared to her. We know she's been trained very well in hand-to-hand combat. So she makes quick work of this guy, even though his hair is even worse in the messed up category after she's done with them.
For me, I think it's fun to see Black Canary. You know, we're talking Diana Drake here, you know, so in the golden age, because she premiered in 1947, right? So she didn't show up in more modern retellings of golden age comics. So like All-Star Squadron, Young All-Star, she's not in those as far as I recall, because she wasn't on the scene. So we didn't see we didn't see quote unquote modern age comics really with her very often to see the original Black Canary in her prime. So this is one of those rare opportunities where we actually get to see, you know, our Black Canary's mom when she was young doing a lot. So, and I know more recently they've sort of retconned her to say she's probably around during World War II, which I'm actually fine with. But in 1991, this was one of those rare opportunities to see her in action.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, Grant Meem, a fantastic artist here. He does a great job with all the characters. You know, there's really good detail on the thugs and on Black Canary. And he does a really good job making her look super sexy, I will say. It's not overdone. It's not cheesecakey, but it's super sexy.
Yeah, absolutely. Every time she's there, it's like, ooh, yeah, okay, I'm noticing that. And he's got a nice style of clean storytelling, right? The panel design is, I don't want to say typical or serviceable. It's more than typical or serviceable. It's nice. It's not anything that's going to blow you away. It's not like when reading a Todd McFarlane comic around this time that you're like, wow, I can't help but notice all the crazy panels. But here, the layouts are very effective. The storytelling is completely clean. You're never confused what's going on. So I think he did a really nice job working on that.
Absolutely. I love the layout on page 5 there. And I love her, you know, radio that's in her motorcycle there where she's on the police band. That's
yeah.
Great.
I do want to give a quick shout out. During the fight with the thugs, there's a great line. I think it's in here really well, where they're calling out sexist behavior, which is the guy's pulled a knife on her. He says, "I'm going to cut you, skirt." And she says, "Really? How are you going to do that when you're too dumb to notice I'm not wearing a skirt?" And then she looks like she probably breaks his arm, actually, quite is what it looks like she does. But I love that they called that out. It was good. And then later she says, "They just don't make looters like they used to. I think it's all the mass production." So I don't know if Black Canary was known for being very snarky in the Golden Age. I don't think many characters were, but I love the way that Len Straczynski is giving her that aspect.
I feel like a lot of characters post Spider-Man got a little more snarky than they were intended to be. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fair. Yeah. I mean, Stan Lee changed the game, right? When he started writing superheroes in the 60s, he gave everyone a lot more personality. He made people a lot funnier. And then people took it from Stan and extrapolated even more. So we get a whole series of generations. I mean, this is even 30 years after Spider-Man came out. So there's years and years of more development of snarky characters. So yeah, there's absolutely a lot of retconning going on with that, which I'm fine though, because I mean, people in the 1940s, they had a sense of humor, so why not?
Mm-hmm. I love how she says the paddy wagon's coming to get them. It's great.
By the way, that radio, did you notice who was calling in? They said, "This is car 54. So Lynn's
<That's>
just Lynn's having a little fun there.
Yeah, Herman Munster's coming.
That's right.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, this is really good stuff here. It's Len Straczynski, like you said, it's not like you're going to open this comic and think, you know, oh my gosh, this is the greatest comic I've ever seen in my life. But him and Meme, the artist here, they're doing a really good job here. There's action, there's intrigue, there was a quiet moment. They're knocking it out of the park already in 6 pages.
Yeah, and this story it's almost a bit of a placeholder, though, because all it really is giving an issue to feature Black Canary. I don't know that it really moves forward the major plot, because we don't really see her battle the constellations. We don't see her battle the big bad. There's just, it's Solomon Grundy trying to steal an item for the big bad. So I don't know how much it moves the plot forward, except it gives you a great highlight on her, which is what we're here for, is to see the JSA characters being awesome.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of like a Secret Origins issue where they would spotlight the character.
Yeah, could be.
Pages 6 and 7 here. I was actually a little shocked. I mean, I know it's the 90s, but wow, this is a really rough scene here. Not only are the cops beat up pretty bad, but the security guard there at the bottom of page 6, I was like, whoa, that kind of caught me off guard there with his neck broken.
Yeah, his neck's broken. It's a close-up on his face. He's got the dead eyes and the hung open mouth. You can kind of see the bent neck piece sticking out. It's pretty gross, yeah. I do want to say, too, every time in this story she interacts with cops, which happens like 2 or 3 times in this issue, I did wonder, is this going to be Larry Lance? Is this how she meets her future husband? So I kept expecting that to happen, and it doesn't, but I was on edge waiting for it.
And I love the top panel on page 7 there. I love her thoughts. She says, "I can't help him now, but maybe I can bring his killer to justice." I know it might sound cheesy, but that's how I want my superheroes. You know, Chris Reeve Superman, that's how I want my superheroes to have their ideals. They're not thinking about revenge or I'm going to kill that guy. She's looking to bring the guy to justice that killed this security guard. And I love it.
You know, I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. You're absolutely right. The true blue super superhero who wants to do the right thing without all the anger and the hatred and the killing in their heart. Yeah, totally. That's what our superheroes were growing up.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like the creative team, they really have this Egyptian stuff down as well. I mean, the artwork is fantastic. I love this museum, the wing that they come to. And again, she just comes flying in. Now, I will say, I'm not sure I condone her like throwing these sarcophagus around with the mummies, wrecking these, you know, things that are thousands of years old. It's like, Canary, can you kind of try to like not do that?
Well, the pyramid she bursts out of like a cake is papier mâché replica. So I was wondering if the sarcophagi were as well until, right, she kicks it and it pops out and literally mummies fall out of it. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that's not going to go over well with the director of the museum, I think.
No, she swings in, drop kicks the one guy right in the face. That's great. And with those boots on, that has got to hurt.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she really cleans their clock. She does a great job in the fight, whether it be, you know, catching it, which she hits him with a flashlight, I guess, first. And then she does the kick on the sarcophagi, which knocks them down. Then she, like you said, kicks the guy in the face. She bursts out of the pyramid and punches the guys. She really does an effective job of taking these guys out. It's really well done.
And I love this because in reality, like this is how it should work. She is a highly trained martial artist. These people are just goons that basically have a knife or a gun. So she should be able to kick the crap out of them pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So she, after she beats the guys, she gets the headdress, right? This crown of Cheops. And, you know, there's this plaque she reads where it says he worship of celestial beings. He's the mentor of Ptolemy, the first astronomer. And then if you look at the headdress itself, there's three illustrations on it. There's one of a guy holding a club and he's holding a dog, which you, when you look at it, you're like, oh, wait a minute. I think that's Orion from last issue because Orion had the club and he turned into a dog. Then you see like a Pegasus creature, like a flying horse. And then you see some sort of bird creature. Now, I don't know how one of those tie in with Sagittarius, but I'm willing to bet one of them probably is going to somehow. So I feel like that they're setting this up that this headpiece is going to really be tied in with controlling whatever these celestial monsters are.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that's a great, you know, little, you know, kind of a in joke there where you can just be like, I'm going to put these here and see if anybody notices. That's, I love it when creators do that kind of stuff, you know.
Really good setup. Really good setup for the future.
Mm-hmm. And wow, it's right below that too, that panel. There's a close up on Canary's face. Really good work there.
Grant Meehan, like I've read a lot of, well, you know, let's talk about him for just a second here. So Grant Meehan, the artist in this issue, he started professionally in 1987 working for Kimiko and Marvel. In fact, I think his first professional work is codenamed Spitfire for Marvel, which is hilarious to me. But he started working in DC by 1988, doing things like Secret Origins, Suicide Squad, Manhunter, Flash, even Starman. And then he gets this gig doing Justice Society. And as we discussed last issue, this series was a placeholder until they could have the Impact line ready to launch. So from there, when he goes on to Impact, he actually works with Mark Waid, and Mark Grant Meehan is the artist and plotter on Legend of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Interesting.
Now, did you ever read any of the Impact books by chance?
I have not, no.
Well, as you can see, as you go through this series, there's an incredible amount of talent in those books. So I've been thinking about rereading them myself because there's so many incredibly talented people. I mean, Tom Lyle, Mike Parabat, Grant Meehan, Rick Burchett. I mean, just incredible amount of talent in those books. So in seeing Grant Meehan do these issues with Black Canary, or this issue of Black Canary, really makes me, because Legend of S.H.I.E.L.D. wasn't one I really stuck with. So now I'm wondering if I should go back and again, Mark Waid as well. Maybe I need to go back and give that book another try.
Hey, it doesn't hurt, man. And I'm going to go find some more of that Kimiko stuff as well, because I do have a couple, they did a couple of horror books and I know I have some of them. I would love to see if he did any work in that stuff too, because like I said, this stuff's great. I really like this.
Looks like he worked on Elementals as a penciler. So
I have a couple of those floating around. Those are, you know, quarter bin fodder.
Exactly. So, exactly.
I see them all the time. Shout out to Professor Allen there. But okay, so we have to talk about page 11 here. You know, you and I talked about this kind of in the back channels before our recording here with, you know, what happens here when Grundy comes face to face with Black Canary. We tried to figure it out and we were kind of like, what's going on here? You know, something must have happened like off panel that we don't know about here, right?
Well, yeah, he comes in, he yells, Bird Lady! And, you know, and she's like, oh, Grundy, old pal, long time no see. Where have you been keeping yourself? In the graveyard? And so the implication is that they fought before. And, you know, me as a reader, I'm like, oh, of course they did. She's in the JSA. You know, it makes perfect sense. And then you asked me about that. You're like, hey, where did they fight last? And in doing my research, I can't find where the Golden Age Black Canary and Solomon Grundy ever met before this in 1991. Whether it be a retcon story or actually published in the 40s, I don't think they'd ever encountered each other.
No, I mean, the first thing I did was like, oh, dummy, go grab that trade that you're going to have for the in-stocks trade pick. Yeah. And there's a bunch of Black, there's no Solomon Grundy in any of those stories at all. Zero.
Now, it could be that, because, you know, JSA was so prolific in the 2000s. You know, we had so many different series and classifieds and all that. It could be that someone retconned a story then that I'm just not remembering. But as far as when we get to 1981, where this is, there had not, as far as I can tell, I'd love for you guys in the comments to tell me I'm wrong. There had not been any encounter with Black Canary and Solomon Grundy. So yeah, we just kind of have to assume that it happened off panel, or it's one of those stories that's just yet to be told.
Yeah, and then I had one other thing for you here too. Like, what do you think of, like, I guess you would call him the head goon here, using, you know, a flashlight or something to hit Grundy? Like, now let me, come on, you put yourself in that situation. Are you going to hit him?
Right. He smacks him with the flashlight, and I'm pretty sure that was the last act that guy ever took, because Grundy then really knocks him on his butt. But I love how it just says slap, but I'm like, no, Grundy broke that guy's neck, crushed his skull, something. That dude is gone. He is over.
Yeah, they, like, you know, B-slap the guy.
Right, like, right.
Crap. And again, somebody that big and powerful, you're going to be, you know, at the hospital for a while, if not dead.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but I do love, as he knocks that guy down, he starts going towards Canary, and she is so nervous. I mean, even we hear a thought balloon of, oh no, I'm in it deep now. So, I like, even though we've never seen it, I love the idea that she's fought him before, but now she realizes, you know, that time, she probably had, I don't know, the Flash or Green Lantern at her back. Now she knows she is way out last.
Mm-hmm. And then we switch scenes, and I need your input on this as well. So, you know, mystery villain here. You guys already, it killed it for me and said who the mystery villain is. Thanks a lot, by the way, in episode one.
Hey, blame Direct Currents and all of DC's marketing that mentioned Vandal Savage's name everywhere. That's not really our fault.
But, you know, so I understand Ted's been through a lot, but he seems very, I don't know. I thought he maybe would had a little more, I just thought he maybe kind of cowers a little too much here. I was like, wait a minute, no way is Ted going to just, you know, take this from this guy. But, you know, he basically does. And then the whole part with the beard, like you said, there's no way that was Vandal Savage in that first issue. No freaking way.
Right. Yeah. As the doomsayer. Yeah. He literally takes the fake beard, throws it down, implying that he was the doomsayer in issue one that gave Ted the map. There's the constellation map. There's no way. Absolutely no way that was Vandal Savage. He's way too scrawny and he's a mess. So I'm not buying that. But Ted being brought low is so sad. So beaten. And now, I've read this series a couple times in my life. I haven't reread it in a few years. So I know Starman is going to be back in action by the end. So I'm hoping there's either a really good redemption arc, or maybe he's faking it a little bit or something. I don't know. We'll have to see how it plays out. But this actually ties in retroactively with what James Robinson did in, like, the Golden Age and the Starman series, because he said that Ted Knight had an emotional breakdown in the 1950s because of his work on the Manhattan Project.
Oh.
And if you tie that with this, whether that's coincidence or not, I don't know. Maybe Robinson was planning that because of this story. I don't know. But it kind of works really well together to explain why Ted Knight is taking this so hard. You know, I mean, there's a panel here that really kind of moves me on page 13, where it's everything's in purple borders except for one panel that's broken out. It doesn't have a panel border. And it's a really far away shot of Ted in the wheelchair, and he's crying. He's actually sobbing, but he's so tiny. It's really an effective tool when you do that artistically, to look at someone from a very far distance away, to really make them feel isolated, especially with no backgrounds in that panel. It's all just white. It's very, it's not an incredibly detailed drawing, but it's very effective in really, you know, hitting you emotionally how bad Ted is.
Yeah, great call out there, that panel. It is really fantastic. And like I said, he's crying. And Savage says to him, now stop whimpering, slave. There is much to do. And then we just see Ted at, like, a desk with his head down in his hands. It's like, wow. Yeah, you really feel bad for Ted here.
Yeah, yeah. It's heartbreaking. It really is. And also in these scenes, by the way, I should mention, Vandal Savage, I'm sorry, the mysterious bad guy, he does specifically call out the name of the constellation from last issue. Like, I remember we said there was the constellation guy. We knew who he was, Orion, but nowhere in the comic did they call him Orion. Vandal Savage now does call him Orion. And then when he calls for Sagittarius, they make sure to say, "Behold, Sagittarius," so that we know the names of these characters now.
Yeah, and I'll say this. I'm way more impressed with Vandal Savage than I am Sagittarius. Sagittarius doesn't really do a whole lot for me as a big bad. It just kind of doesn't. I don't know if you've ever read, there's an issue of Marvel Premiere. I think it's Marvel Premiere 28, where it's a very famous cover where you have all their horror characters on the cover. I think Man-Thing, Morbius, Ghost Rider, and maybe Son of Satan. And they are all kind of facing the reader, and there's a big shadow over them. And they're like, "Oh my gosh, not even we can fight this crazy, you know, threat, monster, whatever." And the villain is something very much akin to this. It's like this golden-skinned, like, guy. And I that was very disappointing to me. Now, this isn't as disappointing, but it's definitely, I love the artwork there on page 15. That's great. But man, as far as like the big bad here, I'm not too scared.
Well, I will reserve judgment to see when Sagittarius fights Alan Scott next issue. So that's what I'm looking forward to. So I'll have to make my decision at that point. I think it's too early. I mean, Orion was pretty impressive the way he held the Flash. So maybe this will work. And I think Parabak might be the artist next issue too. So could really deliver. We'll see.
Yeah. And then back to our Canary fighting our buddy Solomon Grundy. Now, I will say this too. There's only a tiny little nitpicks for me, but nothing major. One of them is the way Grundy's face looks in some of these panels. It looks a little too kind of cartoony for me. Other than that, but it's still a good fight, though. I like it.
Is it the nose that bothers you? Is that what we're...
I think so, yeah. He looks like a pig. He looks like he went full Gil Kane here. what are you doing here, dude? Like, and even on page 17, he looks like, you know, a monster that should be on like a cereal box or something, like with Count Chocula and stuff. It looks, he's about as scary as Sagittarius there, where he's like, "Rawr," coming after her. But I love Canary. She's doing great. And this is something, you know, anybody that's into martial arts will tell you, you know, judo is something where these things would actually be possible. This isn't like just comic book science here. This could really work.
Yeah, so she trips him first, then she's dodging his punches and slides under his leg, so he's falling forward. She uses his own weight to flip him, and then the big one is he comes running at her, she lays down, uses her feet against his stomach, and vaults him over her out a window, like a story or two down into a alleyway, which is just impressive. It's so cool that she is able to fend him off. I mean, she's not beating him up, we know that, but she's staying in the fight and using the judo, using his own weight, his motion, all of it is, it's smart writing, it's smart art, and it's really enjoyable.
Yeah, and she looks great at that panel too, where it's a profile shot and she's looking down in the alleyway at him down there knocked out, and she says, I got him. Like, she's, you know, surprised, but, you know, kind of a little proud of herself. And I'm like, yeah, that's a good moment there, but good profile shot.
It is. She's beautiful. And then the next line on the next page is great too. "Wait till I tell the JSA boys about this. I clobbered Solomon Grundy." I just love how happy and excited she is.
Yeah, and then of course he wakes up and just attacks her. And this is where he like breaks her ribs, I think. And it's like, wow. But I do love how she gets two trash can lids and slaps his ears. That's great.
It really, and you ring, the great sound effect. I mean, she keeps finding ways to give him a hard time. And they even show us in this issue, the guy's bulletproof. So we know there's no way she's going to overpower him at any point. It's just about smart moves and smart actions. And she's really did a great job here.
Yeah, the fuzz shows up, starts shooting at him, does nothing, and then it's like, oh, okay, what's going on? And we see a light from up in the sky, and I almost wish Grundy wouldn't have said who it was, that we would have been a little more surprised maybe by the last page.
Oh, okay. Well, I like her. Like, she's offended that he's leaving. She's like, "Come back here. I'm not through with you." She leaps on his back. And I like that line too, where she's like, "Take that." And she's like, "Wait a minute. Lantern?" Because he just said lantern. So I like that. And that's probably the only disappointing thing for me in this issue is that here we see Diana Drake holding her own against Solomon Grundy for a whole issue. I mean, just phenomenally. And then at the end, she's taken out by random thug number 4 who hits her in the back of the head with a sap. You know, I realize the real answer is because plot. That's why. But it is sort of disappointing that that's how she gets taken out.
Yes, it is. Yeah, like you said, there was a lot of agency given to her in this up until that point. But I will say, she's looking super sexy laying there on page 21. just pointing that out.
I was more looking at the page above where she's leaping on Solomon Grundy's back. I mean, Grant Miam did not miss the opportunity to draw her, again, not overtly, like you said, not overtly sexy, but you just can't help but think the woman's attractive. So
yeah, I mean, her costume, you know, goes down that alley all by itself. He doesn't really need to do anything other other than just draw her with a sexy it's a sexy costume, and she's a very sexy woman. So there you go.
Grant me him. Bless you, sir.
Yep. And then the last page. Wow. I mean, that is a great image, and that is a great way to end it, where you know what's happening page one of the next issue, more than likely. What a way to go out.
Except Alan's kind of giving away his secret identity. He says, back off, Bowman. This is my livelihood you're messing with. And it's the GBC, you know, tower. Like, you know, weren't you just the guy on TV a minute ago then? So anyway.
I mean, maybe Sagittarius will be like, aha, I knew you were a chimney sweep. Who knows?
So overall, I thought this was a great issue. A lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is. This is lots of fun. To me, this is what a comic book is supposed to do. You had fun reading it. The artwork was good. You know, I mean, this is a great comic book. This is what you want to plunk down your 50 cents, dollar, quarter, $2, whatever. To me, I would be happy if I plunked down a dollar for this and read it. I'd be like, oh yeah, I was happy with that.
Now, just to check here, if I remember, you're not reading this with nostalgia goggles either. Like, I believe I had to coerce you into reading this comic. Like, it was a year or two ago I asked you to do one of these stories, but I think I had to coerce you in, so you'd never read these, right?
No, I have a couple issues of this series and the next one, the 92 one that you already covered. I have a couple of random issues I bought here or there, but I had never read them. There in a box. So yeah, this is, you know, first time.
So that's great. So someone reading it today still can enjoy it, and it's not just nostalgia goggles. So that's fantastic. Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
Well, there also, I'll mention the letter column. Now, Chris Lewis, my guest last episode, talked a little bit more about this, so I'll keep it fairly brief. The letter column does sort of explain that DC's working on this quote-unquote big deal. They won't say what it is. It's clearly the Impact line. We know that in retrospect, but they're working on this quote-unquote big deal, and they've lined up all these artists, and unfortunately the big deal is taking a lot longer to complete, so therefore they've got all these artists with no work to do, and they want to be able to pay these people, because they're all freelancers, so they came up with the idea for the Justice Society miniseries to give these people work to do so they can help, you know, feed their families, pay their mortgages, things like that. So they designed the JSA series specifically to fill the time until they could launch the Impact line of books. Then in here, they sort of lay out exactly the reasons for picking the featured JSA members that they picked for these issues. You know, as we said, the main characters are Black Canary, Starman, Hawkman, The Flash, and Green Lantern. And the reason they picked those five characters is because all of them had modern-day equivalents that were on the stands at that point. You know, Flash was Wally West. Green Lantern was Hal Jordan, I guess, at this point. Black Canary obviously had her own series over there, and she was in the Green Arrow book. Hawkman, there was the series, various series out there with Hawkman as well. And then Starman, all those had their own books on the shelf, so that's why they picked these five characters rather than, say, like a Dr. Midnight or a Wildcat or someone like that.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. That was a pretty big risk for DC to be like, here, do this JSA, because not everybody can write and draw, you know, these Golden Age characters. That's not an easy thing to do. Is write the JSA from the 1950s. That's not easy to do. So that's you know, kudos to them.
Exactly. Agreed. And the good news is that they kind of had some experience working with Len Straczynski, because he writes all eight of these issues. So they knew that he had the chops. And I found a lot about him reading this little piece. Like, they revealed that he is a freelance business writer, being printed in things like Advertising Age and Crane's Chicago Business and hundreds of others. He's got a Master's of Science in Industrial Relations and a Master's of Art in Creative Writing. And then he'd been writing Speed Racer and Troll Lords and Starman and Phantom Lady in the Action Comics series. So they had already known that he had the writing chops to do it. And I think he's really, so far, two issues in, he's doing a phenomenal job on this. And the artists are doing a phenomenal job with their storytelling. You know, Rick Burchett made it really feel like we were reading a story about the 1950s. You know, Grant Meehan gave us a story where we've got an amazing female action hero who's really kicking all the butt. So far, the art teams are working really phenomenally.
Yep. Like I said, it was a big risk just taking guys and putting them on this book, but they did a great job, and kudos to them. I think, you know, DC, this is something, like you said, the JSA hadn't even been around for how many years. They had their own book. So that was a risk even bringing them back for this, and then having creators that you really hadn't worked with yet. That's great stuff.
Yeah. And another risk too was the way they laid out the series, which they outline also, by the way, in a letter column. They talk about how they're doing four solo issues. Like, last issue was just The Flash. This issue is just Black Canary. Next issue is just Green Lantern. So they do four solo stories. Then they're going to do two issues. So issues five and six will be team-ups of the characters. Two characters in each team-up. And then the final two issues is going to be the whole team together. So they lay that out here. But they started getting a bunch of nasty letters saying that people weren't happy. They thought, this is called the Justice Society Society of America. Why is it just about the Flash? Why is it just about Black Canary? They didn't like, a lot of readers didn't like that setup, but I think it's very clever.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, to me, I get it. If you think it's a Justice Society, you're thinking there's going to be 5-6 heroes. But yeah, to me, and again, like you said, by the time you get to the middle and end of this series, you did get multiple heroes in the book. So people just need to, you know, calm down, take a break.
Exactly. Exactly. So that is the issue. So now we have to do the unenviable task of assigning the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it is something in a story beat or in the art or something that made us laugh, whatever. Both myself and Billy will pick one moment each to spotlight, and both of those moments will earn an All-Star Award. Now, Billy, you're the guest, so what is your pick for the All-Star Award?
Well, initially, I thought I was going to go with Green Lantern showing up at the end because I do love Green Lantern, especially Alan Scott. But I think I have to say it's when Canary flips Grundy out through the window and says, I got him, I got him. I love that part.
That is exactly my pick as well. So what I'll do is I'll pick a different one just to be so we have multiple ones. But that is exactly what I was going to pick. My second runner-up is her sliding in on the motorcycle and leaping off the motorcycle into action to go kick the looter's butt. So both of those moments are absolutely phenomenal. Both of them deserve an All-Star Award, I think.
And I think, too, when we talked about that panel earlier, when she comes in on the motorcycle, if you look at that small panel right in the middle of the page, it looks like she is riding the motorcycle in a traditional manner. So then she was riding it like that and then flipped off, like all in one motion to the one side. That's pretty awesome.
Good eye. I didn't catch that. You're absolutely right. Okay.
Watch out, Evel Knievel.
Well, congratulations to both moments. You have both won an All-Star Award. So Black Canary, please wear those with pride. They are as tangible as our love for that moment. So, Billy, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit and keeping an eye on all these Egyptian artifacts? I just want to make sure Solomon Grundy doesn't return for another attempt to steal these things.
I was going to say absolutely not, but for you, of course I will.
Oh, you're far too kind. Just remember, judo is your friend. So now don't worry, Billy, we will bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
Hey folks, I want to tell you about Magazines and Monsters, a podcast that's dedicated to comic books as well as classic horror and sci-fi films. This podcast channel contains a bunch of shows like the Bronze Age of Horror Comics, a podcast that's, well, it's about Bronze Age horror comics. There's also The Brave and the Bob, a show celebrating Volume 1 of The Brave and the Bold from DC Comics and all things Bob Haney. But hey, let's not forget the main show itself, Magazines and Monsters, which rotates between old-school horror and sci-fi films with a heavy emphasis on the British studios Hammer and Amicus. Plus, you'll get a selection of episodes about comic books, ranging from DC to Marvel and everything in between. So join your host Billy D and a few of his favorite friends for a fun and positive look at his two favorite pastimes. Find Magazines and Monsters now on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
An heroic legacy beginning in 1941 that spans time, space, and the whole of the multiverse. Journey along with the Knights of the Stars. Ted, David, and Jack. They, along with Will Payton, Michael Thomas, Prince Gavin, Tom Calor, and Courtney Whitmore. They take the mantle of Starman and continue his legacy. I invite you to listen as I journey through these adventures of all these heroes and the rest of the Starman family here on Opal City Confidential, a Starman podcast.
The Society Pages. The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. Now, before we get into the feedback, I do want to give a plug for a friend of mine's podcast called Fan Films Friday. Clinton Robinson was kind enough, or foolish enough, depending on how you see it, to invite me to come on his show to discuss a fan film all about Jesse Quick. So you can check that out as part of the Lone Box Crusade on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now remember, folks, get out on the social media and share your love for JSA and this issue, because as I always say, it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Most importantly, go out to our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA, and leave your comments on the show post. Now, as I always mention, we do appreciate any assistance you can give us with the iTunes or Apple Podcast reviews. If you haven't left a review yet, please consider it. It really helps to raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. All you got to do is look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents. And as a thank you, I will read your entire iTunes Apple Podcast review on the air. The only thing I ask is if you're outside of the United States, just give me a heads up that you left a review, because otherwise I won't know to find your review unless I filter to your specific country. All right, this time, big thanks go out to Michael CPA for his review on iTunes. He writes, "Found my joy. I waited until the first 10-issue series was recorded and complete, so this week I got to enjoy episode 1, only 16 months after it was posted. It was awesome. Two of my favorite podcasters, the Irredeemable Shag and Michael Bailey, one half of the Mount Rushmore of comic podcasters, in my opinion. Thoroughly loving the issue and projecting all the fun associated with the issue and the series, and I'm assuming all the way through the 90s. Keep it going, Shag." Well, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate that. I'm so glad you enjoyed the first episode. I hope you continue to enjoy the rest, and I hope you eventually get to hear this one. All right, now we're going to dive into your feedback. I have collected all your comments from the last episode that I could find on our website and also on social media. I put it all in a Google document, and boy, did y'all have a lot to say about issue number 1 of this miniseries. So obviously I won't be reading every word, but I am going to acknowledge every single person that left a comment on the website and try and read a portion of their comments. So, again, we are covering our previous episode discussing Justice Society of America number 1 with my guest, Dr. Chris Lewis. First, we heard from Tyler Bradford. He says, "Hi guys, I'm such a huge fan of the Justice Society Presents podcast. I look forward to it each month. I've been a fan of the JSA since I saw ads for Geoff Johns' first run comparing the original characters to the newer legacy versions. I was wondering, is there a plan to talk about the homage Justice Guild characters from the Justice League cartoon? Again, thanks for all the content. You guys are great." Well, thank you, Tyler. I really appreciate that. Now, that story was covered over on the JLU cast, which our buddies Chris and Cindy Franklin do, but I do think I'll touch on it when this podcast becomes JSA in the 2000s. I'll find some way to address the Justice Guild, because, come on, it's such a great episode of that cartoon, right? Then we heard from Juan Maldonado. He says, "Just discovered you guys. Looking forward to catching up on the shows I've missed. Wondering if you've done a spotlight on Dr. Fate yet." You know, Juan, we haven't. I really am looking forward to doing a Dr. Fate spotlight. He's one of my absolute all-time favorite characters, and there's a ton of content from the 90s. Just got to work it into the schedule somewhere. So thanks, Juan. Then we heard from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star, The Space Princess, and other stories. He says, "Oi, another, quote, in a wheelchair but got better character. Is there a union at this point between Batman, Batgirl, Professor X, and Wildcat twice, and Moon Knight? As a wheelchair user myself, I don't always hate cures. What I do hate is willing yourself to walk. That way leads to heartbreak and poor grades in modern dance. The fact that some characters get cured and others don't takes me out of the story." Then Dustin Gibbons followed up on Rob's comments. It says, "Dustin, I agree about hating the whole willing yourself out of your disability leading to heartbreak. It also leads to false hope and people not quite understanding how disability works. I've been in a chair for about 17 years-ish now, and yeah, I still have family members who don't quite understand that this is my normal. I have good health days and bad health days, because that's how it is with chronic condition. I don't mind a cure in comics, but I would love for it to be believable. Perhaps a surgery, then physical therapy to get the strength back, and so on and so forth. With that said, in a magical universe with super technology, it can be super hard to justify certain kinds of disabilities still being a thing, I guess. I wasn't trying to say that representation shouldn't be a thing in comics. I just think that sometimes writers can find it difficult. With that said, I love it when in fiction you see someone get disabled or born disabled and go through the psychological stages that leads to acceptance of their disability. Then see a character still be disabled but thrive as a disabled person. I really, really enjoyed Oracle as a character. I also like Daredevil and Dr. Midnight as well. Disability, in my opinion, is hard for non-disabled people to handle in fiction sometimes. Like you, I don't always hate disability cures, but I want them to be written well. I do like it better when they aren't cured, but shown accepting it and living with it. Imagine a disabled Green Lantern using a green construct exosuit or something. Always nice to see a fellow disabled person lurking about. Well, I just want to say thank you to Rob and Dustin for sharing that insight. You're coming at this from a whole different perspective than most of us, and I really appreciate you being willing to open up and share with us. Now, Dustin continues on saying, the whole Starman being a New Mexico thing may be a link to the Roswell alien conspiracy theories about space. You know, people think of stars, they think of space, they think of Roswell, New Mexico. Could be, but Dustin, that's a good thought. Dustin goes on to say, Jay Garrick is a somewhat controversial character in our household as a kid in a funny way. He was my grandmother's Flash, and she felt the same about Golden Age characters as some people now feel about Silver Age versions. People of a certain age see Barry and Hal as a definitive Flash and Green Lantern, but for her, it was Jay and Alan, so on and so forth. That's so cool, Dustin. I love that. You know, when I was a kid, I was reading some comic with the JSA, I don't remember, and my mom walked by for whatever reason, and she looked at the comic and saw Alan Scott, and she goes, hey, that's Green Lantern. That's the Green Lantern I remember. And I was like, what? My mother had never mentioned any interest in comic books. And out of the blue, she points to Alan Scott and says, that's her Green Lantern. Blew my mind. So yeah, I mean, there's generations of people that came before us, and those are their characters. Absolutely right. All right, up next we hear from J. David Weider from the Bat Pod. Dave says, fantastic episode. Great guest, great episode. And Shag was there too. Thanks, Dave. As for the Impact line of comics, I'm a big fan. Love the Comet and the Fly. Also, I was about to type a comment about the dog constellation, but Shag stopped me just in time. Glad that on-the-fly research paid off for me, Dave. Then we heard from Dr. Chris Lewis, who was the guest last episode. In fact, he replied to a bunch of the comments on our website. So what a great guest to then come back and do all this feedback. I mean, I almost don't even have to do a feedback episode because Chris did so much responses to the feedback. But here we go. So regarding to Dave, he says, thank you, Dave. I can confirm that Shag was more than just there. He also pressed record. Thanks, guys. And then Chris says, Impact was great for me as a new comics reader, and I often think back to the comment as a great example of serial storytelling with some twists and turns that I genuinely did not see coming. All right, up next, we heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters Under Siege, an Avengers podcast. Tim says, off to a great start with this miniseries. It's a lot of fun, and your discussion was excellent as always. I did buy this one monthly as it came out, and while the follow-up series is what truly made me a JSA fan, this mini sure wet my whistle, as the kids say. I was not expecting to see a callback to New Mexico in Starman in the first issue. I absolutely remember our discussion of it, but doubt I checked the location of Ted's observatory in the mini at the time. Fun to see it all come together, especially this Straczynski connection. Then Tim goes on to say, honestly, I'm not sure Vandal Savage was obvious to me back in the day as the bad guy. Of course, I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, but by this point, I mostly knew him as a Wally West foe and wouldn't automatically link him to the JSA like I would today. It's obvious in hindsight, so that's interesting to me. Well, then again, Dr. Chris Lewis chimes in and says, Vandal Savage's immortality allows DC to use him in different and interesting ways throughout his timeline. This, being the first time I'd encountered him, is what I would consider classic Vandal Savage. But I also enjoyed how he was used in books like Resurrection Man and Demon Knights. He's got a potential to set off a plan in, say, the 15th century Spain when it comes to fruition in 21st century Texas. I think he's a character that imaginative writers can have a field day with. Chris, you're dead on there. Man, that Demon Knights book, Vandal Savage was fantastic in that book, and it really got to see a different side of him, so I really enjoyed it. They were from Super Captain, who says, brilliant show, Shag and Dr. Chris. I had to quit comics for a bit when this series originally came out, but I did go back and pick up a hardcover of it not long ago. Living Constellations are a very 1950s-sounding concept. The penultimate panel on page 6, in which we, along with Jay, see Ted in the wheelchair for the first time, is very effective, portraying the surprise on Jay's face and Ted's head hanging in despair. Then that's followed up on page 7 by the reveal that Ted is being controlled by a shadowy master, Vandal Savage. High drama indeed. Then Super Captain says, I didn't catch the DC Impact versions of Archie heroes, but I enjoyed Ian Flynn's take on them in his Mighty Crusaders series a few years back, and I did read the revivals by JMS, wrote for DC. Yeah, the Impact or Red Circle characters, whatever you want to call them, they've really come back around a few times, so there's lots of versions out there for you to check out. Then Chris Lewis again chimes in and goes, by Impact, because sadly I suspect the rights issues around these characters are so convoluted, reprints of the Impact books could never happen. Time to hit the back issue bins, I guess. And actually, you know, Chris, a few people have been hitting the back issue bins for the Impact issues, and I'm not going to necessarily claim credit for it, but I think we may help spur something here. Helping the economy, that's what we're doing. Then we heard from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, this sounds like a fun series. I'm currently reading several books and comics set in World War II. The Adventures of the Peerless Peer by Philip Jose Framer with Sherlock Holmes and Watson have been called upon to fight in World War II, in a shared universe where they've already met G8, the Shadow, and have just met Tarzan himself. Wow, that sounds pretty cool. It's like a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen or Defenders of the Earth for that genre of characters. That's awesome. Then we're from Hal, who says, all this talk of Impact Comics started me thinking about the Archie character, the Comet. If my aging memory isn't failing me, I believe the original Comet died and was replaced by his brother. That would make him one of the first heroes to die. Marvel then had a one-shot hero back in the 60s or early 70s called the Comet. I seem to remember there was some controversy at the time with Archie claiming that this was an unauthorized use of their IP, and then he died again in Impact, making him one of the few characters who have died in three separate continuities. Well, Dr. Chris Lewis did some research here. He says, I think this might be the 1940 Comet in Pep Comics number 1, alter ego John Dickering. He was apparently the first superhero to die in a comic in issue 17 of that title in July 1941, after which his brother became a hero called the Hangman. Drawn by Jack Cole, John Dickering discovered a gas that was 50 times lighter than hydrogen, which he injected into his bloodstream, which is both scientifically impossible and medically highly inadvisable. But hey, Golden Age comics, right? Thank you, Chris. Then we heard from Brett Miller, who says, I did not read this miniseries. Vandal Savage is one of my favorite DC villains. The perfect redundant name is, well, perfect. His superpower was one I thought would be great to have until I examined it deeper. There could be no greater hell than seeing everyone you care about grow old and die. No wonder he became a big bad that he did. You know, Brett, that's a good point. That would be pretty rough, wouldn't it? Although Doctor Who seems to pull it off, so I don't know. Then we heard from Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, Time Problems, and The Pure Shore Club. Jason writes, to carry the dog constellation info even further, not only is the dog constellation named Canis Major, but Canis Major is supposed to be the Orion's hunting dog. There we go. Thank you, Jason. And he says, it's disappointing they don't name the constellations in this series. As a kid, I learned about the Zodiac and the Greek gods through Avengers comics. Comics can be educational, so who knows how much constellation knowledge this series could have imparted on kids. Well, Jason, it looks like they're trying to make a few amends for that in issue 2 here, because again, they did refer to Orion from issue 1. They did name Sagittarius, so they are making an effort to name the constellations, at least at this point. I hope it continues. Then we're from Diablo Frank from the World Spine Podcasting Network, including the DC Secret Files and Origins podcast. Frank, as usual, has written quite a lot, so I'm going to just skim through some of it. Most importantly, this first comment proves that Frank actually listened to the episode. He says, I'm not going to say that I didn't send Shag the direct currents, but if I did, it was either a double or predated my building of a modest collection of them. I grabbed some direct currents new, but I didn't value them, and tossed them into the quarter bins at my shops. In recent years, finding them inspired nostalgia, and they're really thin, so even a few dozen of them doesn't take up much space. Why not see how many I can get, if they're cheap enough? Well, Frank, I may be wrong, but my memory is that those direct currents came from that box you mailed me. You know, remember that, like, 500-pound box that you mailed to my house that I had to pick up and I threw out my back? Yeah, that box. Yeah, real friendship there, buddy. Then Frank goes on to say, my understanding is that the Impact line was intended to be an accessible entry point line for young readers that initially got newsstand distribution. But it seems like that line was utterly crushed by the avalanche of better options in the boom years. Little kids preferred actual Archie comic licenses like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or the Disney Comics Revival. If they were interested in superheroes, they had plenty of ones that they actually knew of from TV and movies. Plus, they wanted the Flash and the Mutant Genesis, not the patronizing little kid look of Impact. I think most of their readership were old dudes who cared about the legacy, like the JSA readership, and those books didn't even last as long as Impact. And then Frank says, with all this talk about Impact, I was curious about when Mike Parabek did his JSA work versus the Fly release schedule. But it was more of a team-up. Parabek was a two-book-a-month man. Then he goes on to name a bunch of examples, and they're out there on our website if you want to see them. But yeah, so Parabek was drawing two comics a month for quite a while. That's amazing. I mean, what a workhorse, that guy. Wow. Then we heard from Jose Rivera, author of The Underground Adventures. He says, Chris mentioned the JSA as having a purity of principle, and man, do I love that. One of the reasons we love these characters is that they're not overly complicated. They know what's right, and there's something so earnest about who they are and what they fight for. They don't need overly tragic backstories. They don't need deconstruction. They're who they are, and we love them for it. You know what else I love about this issue? I love Jay's helmet being slightly tilted to the side in many panels. I don't know, just looks cool. And as someone who was a kid when Impact Comics came out and who loved seeing all these new characters, it really makes me miss the days when we had these companies with new universes to discover, whether they were shared universe like Impact, Malibu, Ultraverse, or Valiant, or whether they did their own thing like Now Comics and that awesome Green Hornet series that they did, which, much like Starman, tied all the previous versions from the serial and television series together as a legacy, even including the Lone Ranger. Jose, I'm so glad that Impact Comics bring you joy. And if I remember correctly, I think you're one of the folks that have been buying some up from the discount bins and making a collection. So that's awesome, Jose. Then we're from John Stibus, who goes, this was another fun episode, gang. I bought this series and enjoyed it at the time, but I enjoyed the ongoing series more as it was set in the present day. I also bought all the Impact titles. I was working at a comic shop in Milwaukee when Image Comics launched in the summer of 1992. The books were selling like crazy, but I, like some comic readers, felt they were more style than substance. I specifically remember someone coming in asking about those new Image titles like Spawn. I thought I was saving the industry by directing them to the Impact section on the racks. The customer was confused, and I thought I was clever, but I also felt like I was doing the right thing. Even though I was working at the shop, eventually I was buying so many shared universe superhero comics from the Ultraverse to Milestone to Valiant to Impact and more. If I'm being honest, I miss those days. You know, John, you and I both worked in comic shops at the same time, and like you, I loved so many of those shared universes, like Milestone and Ultraverse and Impact and all those things. I just read the mess out of those things, and I miss those days too. Then we're from Lizanne Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. A little bit different perspective. This one wasn't quite for Liz. She says, so this was the storyline before the one y'all read last time. Interesting. Not my thing, but okay. The art has a good storytelling, and all this stuff is credible. I'm just not a fan. Decent enough story, though. Well, Liz, I hope maybe as the issues go on, you might find something you enjoy. Then we're from Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for Girl blog. Martin says, oh, well done, Shag. I've been waiting for this set of episodes to begin. It is such a refreshing series. Zippy characterizations, breezy art, and a very intriguing setup for the first issue. So far, as the complaints about it taking so long for the team to reunite in this mini is concerned, I was with them. Yes, the original All-Star Comics had the format of solo adventures with everyone coming together for a few pages at the end, but that was when comics had 64 pages to play with. The 90s had perhaps a third of that page count, and was proportionally a lot more money. The title was Justice Society of America. Had it been All-Star Comics, there'd be less reason to complain, perhaps. And yes, it is the best logo ever. And I love the Impact line with the Jaguar and the Comet as my favorites. I haven't read it probably since first publication, but I really remember liking the Jaguar comic. Then we're from Chris Franklin from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as the Mr. and Mrs. Superman stories right here on the JSA Presents feed, as well as JLU Cast and more. Chris says, great first episode. Dr. Chris Lewis is always a welcome guest. I was so excited when this miniseries came out. At the time, I felt like I was one of the few fans who still remembered or cared about the JSA. If we couldn't have them back in the present yet, why not do a series set in the past? As for the Impact line, I was all in on this when it started. My favorite series was The Fly, followed by The Jaguar. I didn't stick with them too long, but I did get all the Who's Who issues and the binder. Unfortunately, my closet had a leak in it, and the binder and the Who's Who entries died in a rainstorm. But they did protect my other comics, so they died a heroic death. Well, Chris, if they had to go out, I guess that's a great way to go. Then Jordan Jennings from the Extremely Uncanny and host of the podcast Neverending Battle chimed in and says, fantastic! Just caught up with the show, and I'm eager to hear your coverage of the 91 miniseries. Awesome, Jordan. I hope you're enjoying it. We also heard from Anthony Cardino, who's also catching him on the podcast, and Robert Junker says he's reading along with us. Then moving on to Gord Tolton from the Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante podcast. Gord says, post-Crisis and post-Last Days, All-Star Squad and Infinity Inc., etc., this is how I wanted to see the JSA portrayed. In period, in prime, in real history. While I will take the JSA any way I can get them, I always felt like this was the proper rendition, both keeping continuity and creating it. Nice way to think about it, Gord. I like that. Then this is a little bit of feedback from the future. Just today, I was promoting this episode, and I said, you know, this episode with Solomon Grundy's coming out on Sunday. And Silverman on security called me out and says, you can't post a Solomon Grundy episode on a Sunday. It's got to be born on a Monday. I do not make the rules. I laughed so hard at that. So, Silverman, what I recommend is you just download it on Sunday, but wait to listen until Monday. How's that? Is that a fair balance? All right, folks. Well, this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared our show on their social media timelines. We're talking Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. It is a long list of names. There's no denying that, right? But these folks helped to support the show and promoted the show, and so it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. This is the only time DC New Earth 2 is going to get mentioned in this episode, but you know what? He's part of our family. He's part of our JSA family, so he deserves to get the credit. So, and you can be on this list next month, folks. It's really easy just by sharing or retweeting or reskeeting or whatever it's called on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, extra Twitter, and Threads. And this time out, we got over 70 people to help promote the last episode. Our thanks go out to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Alan Williams, Alan Boyce Jr., Andre Freitas, Andrew R., the Redheaded Fanboy, Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Between the Pages Blog, Billy D., Black Vulcan 69, Brett Young, Brian Schufo, Chris Franklin, Chris Mort, Clinton Robison, Codex Omniversa, Comic Foil, Craig McDonald, Dan Dougherty, Dave's Comics Heroes Blog, DC at Retro Cabal, DC New Earth 2, DC Special Cast, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank, Dr. Chris Lewis, Dr. Pop Culture, Ed Moore, El Thanagar Yano, Extremely Jordan, Fan Films Friday Podcast, Gotham by Geeks, Grumpy Old John, J. David Weeder, John Stibe, Jordan Jennings, J.P. Roca, Justice Trek, Justin Steiner, Keith G. Baker, Con L., Lizanne Oswald, Magazines and Monsters, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matthew Barton, Michael Bailey, Mike Thomas, Mo Walker, Outcasters Under Siege, an Avengers podcast, Paul Kean, Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Pop Culture Basement, Protest and Musica, Richard Field, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, S. Matthew Stolte, Scott X, Sean Ross, Silverman on Security, Stephen Arels, The Bat Pod, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Telltale Mind, Tim Price, Uncle Bruno's Customs, Venkman, Victor Perfecto, Watch This Space, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew. My thanks to all of you for your support of the JSA and the 90s podcast, folks. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show. I mean it. This community of JSA fans we're building together is absolutely the best. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Dr. Chris Lewis. I do my best to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet fingers. And quite frankly, Instagram is being a bit of a pain in me trying to figure out who reshared posts. I'm working on that, though. So please keep those cards and letters coming, folks. You can visit our website at firewaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post there, and fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts and communicate together. You can also find us on most social media platforms as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. You can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. My thanks again to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, Billy D, and we'll see how he managed with the Egyptian artifacts in Solomon Grundy.
World on Fire,
an All-Star Squadron podcast.
Join your hosts, Billy D.
and Herman, as we take a deep dive into the seminal DC Comics series created by Roy Thomas and Rich Buckler.
We'll be covering the series issue by issue, spotlighting our favorite characters,
and talking about the historical tie-ins as well.
So join us every month in A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast.
Coming in December 2020 to a podcatcher near you.
Hi, I'm Mike Garvey. You might remember me from podcasts such as Waiting for Doom, DZOTD, or The Gary Show. And I've made a terrible decision. I've started a podcast where I read Detective Comics, one issue at a time, across 80-plus years, on purpose. It's called The Detective Phase. If you like comics, historical deep dives, or listening to a grown adult lovingly explain why stories from as far back as 1939 still matter, this show is absolutely for you. And if you've ever loved Batman and thought, what if someone took this way too seriously? The Detective Phase has you covered. New episodes twice a month, wherever you get your podcasts, on the Waiting for Doom feed, or at waitingfordoom.com. Therapy pending. I heard that Dr. Herkenstephner might be available.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, Billy is back with us. Billy, thank you so much for appearing on this episode of the show. Thank you for agreeing to read this comic for the first time. I really appreciate it. And why don't you tell the listeners at home where they can find more of you on the interwebs?
So if you go to most social media sites, you can find me either as Doc Strange, or I just recently jumped onto Instagram, and it's just Magazines and Monsters. And then, of course, you can go to any reputable podcast app and find Magazines and Monsters, or dig back through the archives for A World on Fire and All-Star Squadron podcast to hear me vamp about Earth 2 stuff.
And folks, it's well worth that searching those out. Billy is a fantastic podcaster, as you can tell from this already, if you haven't already been listening to his shows. And that All-Star Squadron podcast is amazing. So all of it well worth your time. Well, thank you, Billy. Again, I really appreciate being on the show, and I can't wait till we talk again sometime soon.
Well, thanks for having me, Shag. I appreciate it, buddy. This was a lot of fun. And yeah, first time read, I'm right there with you. So I'm going to try to get the rest of these issues and follow along with you, buddy.
Awesome. I hope you do. It's a great series, and it's well worth it. Well, that is going to do it, folks. Now come back next episode when we probably cover Justice Society of America number 3, or it might be a spotlight episode. I haven't made up my mind yet. I've got a couple different ideas floating around. We'll see how they all pan out. Either way, I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover whatever the topic's going to be. And who will that guest be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Billy.
And we're asking you to join the fight.
For justice.